George King made his way to the top of a 116-meter hotel in the Spanish city of Barcelona without any ropes or safety measures. The 21-year-old scaled the building in only about 20 minutes. However, as he was climbing down the building, he was arrested by police. This is not the first time the British daredevil has risked his life with such a nail-biting climb. Last December, he scaled Barcelona's iconic Agbar Tower with a height of 144 meters. In 2019, he also free-climbed the 310-meter Shard building in London. The feat, however, earned him 6 months in a young offenders center.
A chocolate maker in the Belgian city of Bruges has come up with a novel recipe to boost business in the run-up to Easter.
When you're a classic chocolate maker, make very classic recipes. Caramels, praline, marzipan, and it's okay. We have classic bonbons too. But I think today, the customer wants to go on adventure, also when they are eating something.
The chocolatier's special concoction is a praline made of grass juice, Granny Smith apples, and an East Asian type of lemon. He believes chocolate contains a secret ingredient that can counter the lockdown glue. Belgium is known as the chocolate capital of the world. The northern city of Bruges is in particular renowned for treating your taste buds to quality cocoa. However, the coronavirus pandemic has diminished foreign tourist numbers, with businesses now relying on local customers. This is heart-melting. A video of a stray cat carrying her sick newborn kitten to a veterinary clinic in Turkey is melting hearts online. Veterinarians were confused as a cat walked into their clinic clutching one of her kittens in her mouth. The cat then meowed for a long time and brought in a second kitten of hers. After a quick examination, the vets noticed that the kittens couldn't open their eyes due to an eye infection. The clinic staff immediately treated the animals, helping them open their eyes after a while. The stray feline and her kittens were placed in adoption after the completion of their treatment. Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Magura River to see stunning cherry trees in full bloom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital were also canceled.
In the heart of one of the oldest districts in the U.S. state of California, there is a historical little printing house that is receiving a new lease on life. The building and its equipment were slowly dying out, and its machines were good for scrap. The iconic printing house was on the verge of bankruptcy until a group of artists revived this beacon of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. Artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
According to an analysis by Richard Heath, published by The Guardian in 2019, Chevron is responsible for more carbon emissions since 1965 than any other investor-owned fossil fuel company. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Katie Mulvey Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Several Ways Chevron Imperils Climate, Human Rights, and Racial Justice. Here's more. Although we are barely one quarter into 2021, multiple forces are squeezing Chevron for the preventable harm it is inflicting on the global climate. The company is also being dragged for its greenwashing, its role in perpetuating racial justice in the United States, and its violations of indigenous people's rights. Campaigners are calling for votes against both the board chair and the lead independent director on the basis of failures to oversee climate performance. Last year, a majority of Chevron shareholders rebuked corporate leadership by demanding increased disclosure of the company's climate lobbying. According to an analysis by Richard Heath, published by The Guardian in 2019, Chevron is responsible for more carbon emissions since 1965 than any other investor-owned fossil fuel company. In early March, Chevron announced new climate goals and published a new climate report, which said Chevron intends to reduce its global warming emissions by about 5% over the next 7 years. Underwhelming, to say the least. Food dragging on climate policy. Chevron's climate-related policy positions are as pathetic as its emissions reduction goals. In February, when Chevron issued a report on climate lobbying in response to last year's shareholder vote, the company falsely claimed that its positions line up with the Paris Agreement. Climate Action agrees that Chevron's lobbying is not Paris-aligned. From that deception, it was an easy sidestep for Chevron to give a seal of approval to each of the trade associations to which it belongs, including the American Petroleum Institute, API. Earlier this year, French oil and gas company Total withdrew from the API over the lobbying group's lack of support for the Paris Agreement. API has done some fancy footwork since Total's departure, including releasing a new climate action framework. But the latest greenwashing by a group with a decades-long history of climate disinformation deserves its own block. For now, check out this story on recent research by the Stanford University scholar Ben Franta. Chevron now publishes a list of trade associations to which the company pays more than $100,000 in annual dues. But trade associations aren't the only industry groups through which fossil fuel giants wield influence over climate policy. Take the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, a bill mill that has opposed renewable energy and emissions reduction policies at the state level. As far as we can tell, Chevron has not joined Shell, BP, and ExxonMobil in severing ties with the ALEC. While Chevron's climate actions are decidedly understated, its climate ads are dangerously overstated. That's why Earthworks, Global Witness, and Greenpeace USA represented by Richmond Law and Policy, filed a greenwashing complaint to the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, against Chevron. The complaint argues that Chevron's ads are unlawfully deceptive because they overstate the company's investment in renewable energy and its commitment to reducing fossil fuel pollution. The groups are asking the FTC to require Chevron to remove the ads, refrain from placing similar ads in the future, and face relevant penalties. See how UCS scientists reacted to one of Chevron's deceptive ads back in 2018. With greenwashing attracting unwelcome attention, fossil fuel clients could become a liability for public relations firms. And some ad agencies are already starting to back away, as they did from the tobacco industry. After tweeting that Black Lives Matter during racial justice protests in June 2020, Chevron faced scrutiny over the harm it has inflicted and continues to inflict on communities of color near its facilities in Richmond, California, and elsewhere around the world. Faith and values-based investors submitted a shareholder proposal requesting that Chevron commission an independent third-party report analyzing how the company's policies, practices, and the impacts of its business perpetuate racial injustice and disparately impact people of color. The SEC ruled that Chevron could prevent shareholders from considering the proposal on the basis that it relates to the company's legal strategy and could harm its defense in ongoing litigation and thus interfere with its ordinary business. In Chevron's case, ordinary business means burning fossil fuels like there is no tomorrow, and the litigation in question seeks to hold Chevron and other fossil fuel polluters accountable for climate damages and fraud. Or, as Chevron's legal team at Gibson Dunn put it in the SEC filing, the alleged resulting injuries, including the alleged harmful impacts of climate change on the communities of color. Indeed, many of these legal complaints, including those filed by Charleston, South Carolina, Upcom, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., Delaware, Minnesota, and most recently, Annapolis, Maryland, emphasize how climate impacts hurt low-income communities and communities of color first and worst. The proposal that won't be put to a shareholder vote next month also called for an examination of how Chevron's public policy advocacy aligns with respect for civil rights. While Chevron professes support for Black Lives, Global Witness found that the company gave over 4 times more funding to politicians who fail to uphold voting rights than to those who do. And back to ALEC here. The group is crafting model legislation and lobbying to roll back voting rights in dozens of states to a level not seen since the end of Reconstruction. Rollbacks recently passed in Georgia will disproportionately affect Black voters. ALEC is also behind critical infrastructure laws that target indigenous and environmental activists protesting oil and gas pipelines. Nearly a decade ago, indigenous people and farmers won a $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron over deadly pollution from oil and gas production in the Ecuadorian Amazon, dating back to the 1980s. Not only does Chevron refuse to pay to clean up its mess and address the ongoing health crisis it created, the company and its lawyers at Gibson Dunn, remember them from SEC challenges, are blocking access to justice for the affected communities. Chevron has engaged in a ruthless, unprecedented, and sustained attack on the Ecuadorian plaintiff's attorney. These examples actually illustrate a stunning array of corporate abuse, deception, and misconduct by one of the world's largest and most powerful corporations. They also provide incredible opportunities for cross-sector, cross-issue organizing and campaigning to hold Chevron accountable as it prepares to face its stockholders.
A new report suggests there was a 33% rise in crimes in major U.S. cities last year amid then prevailing anger over racial injustice and police brutality across the country. The report released by the Major Cities Chiefs Association includes murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. It says 63 of the 66 largest police jurisdictions saw increases in at least one category of violent crimes. This as the surge in homicide rates in the U.S. is both historic and far-reaching. The report suggests that a crime surge has continued into the first quarter of 2021. In Chicago, murders are up 33% in the first 3 months of the year compared to 2020, while shootings are up nearly 40% for the same period. In New York City, the NYPD figures show murders has jumped by nearly 14% through March 28, while shootings were up nearly 50%. In Los Angeles, homicides have increased nearly 36% from 67 to 91 through March 30th. Those three cities also saw a significant increase in 2019 too. The increase in homicide rate in the three cities come as Chicago, Houston, and Memphis last year saw an increase of 100 or more killings compared to 2019.
With all of the marches and the protests, some of the word that I was hearing from the street, from people that I know that were out there in the street, the elements, they were telling me that a lot of law enforcement was in certain places, they were just saying, work slow down. They weren't going to be as pushing to go after criminals as you know, from the way they were in the past, because they felt like a lot of them were being thrown under the bus. So I believe that you might, with the, if the criminal element knows that and understands that, then a lot of times they will use that opportunity to do the their nefarious acts and to go after people to get revenge, everything else, because they feel like they're hearing that there's a police slowdown, work slowdown. So I think all of that, when you add all of that into it, and then you add the economic situation of the pandemic, the fact that people don't have access to the, you know, the resources, money, and the things they did have, it just opened up a can of worms.
Chicago alone saw 18 homicides in a single day, its largest number of murders on record. The surge in crimes and killings are blamed on a number of factors, ranging from economic collapse to social anxiety caused by COVID-19 to depolicing in major cities, to the release of criminal defendants pre-trial or before sentences are completed to reduce risk of COVID-19 spread in jails. COVID-19 seemed to further exacerbate things. Officers sometimes had to quarantine because of exposure or cases in their ranks. That especially came into light following the killing of African-American George Floyd at the hands of white U.S. police officers, which set up the largest protest movements in American history in late May last year. It's nearly impossible to attribute any year-to-year change in violent crimes statistics to any single factor. However, many believe the COVID-19 pandemic, the subsequent economic hardships, and anti-racism protests are to blame for the spike in the number of crimes. But the question is why the U.S. has such a high crime rate.
Well, again, in the United States, is more than any other nation in the world, has more guns on the street than any place else. So our gun laws have made it easy
for people to obtain weapons. And, of course, a lot of these crimes are committed with guns. So when we look at the extraordinary amount of guns that are on the street, as I said before, the cat's already out the bag. And then the fact that you have, so people have the means to do criminal activity. And then if you have a police slowdown, work slowdown, because law enforcement is upset because they feel like they're being thrown under the bus. They're not being thrown under the bus. And if they feel that way, then you have a work slowdown. If that gets to the street, and the criminal element here is that law enforcement is not going to be investigating them the way they normally do, then you're going to have an uptake in crime, in violent crime. That's going to automatically happen.
What's Trump to be blamed?
Crime is out there, and you can't really stop it, which that's been the problem. I don't know if you can blame the Trump administration, other than the fact that the rhetoric on law enforcement, instead of them addressing the issue of police brutality and police misconduct, the rhetoric was like, well, you know, don't do anything wrong. And that wasn't the right rhetoric, because the bottom line is people felt like a lot of groups were emboldened to do things that normally they would not have done before. So in that sense, maybe the administration had some culpability.
There are some other factors conducive to the dire situation in the U.S. Some say America's list of woes appears to be too long. The economy is on the decline, wages are low, economic growth is down, the U.S. companies are not competitive in global markets, and the gap between the haves and have-nots is going deeper and deeper. All these problems, compounded by the highest surge in crime rates, have made many thinkers and observers in the U.S. obsessed with decline, and the concept has ushered the new school of thought, declinism.
President Joe Biden has held his first talks with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky amid simmering tensions in eastern Ukraine. During the phone call, the U.S. president reaffirmed Washington's support for Ukraine, accusing Russia of committing acts of aggression. The rising tensions follow a series of reported clashes in eastern Ukraine. Kiev has accused pro-Russian forces of killing four Ukrainian soldiers in the Donbas region late last month. Pro-Russian forces controlling eastern Donetsk and Luhansk regions also say a drone attack by the Ukrainian army has killed a 5-year-old child and injured a woman. Donbas has been the scene of a conflict between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces since 2014. The armed confrontations began when a wave of protests in Ukraine overthrew a democratically elected pro-Russia government and replaced it with a pro-West administration. The majority in those areas refused to endorse the new administration. That new government then began a crackdown on the mainly ethnic Russians in the east, who in turn took up arms and turned the two regions of Donetsk and Lugansk, collectively known as the Donbass, into self-proclaimed republics.
I'm intimately familiar with this area, and these people who live there are ethnic Russians. They're slightly different from the Ukrainians, but they're Russians. They speak the Russian language. They're Russian people. They moved there over the centuries, and this is their homeland.
Kiev and its Western allies accuse Moscow of having a hand in the crisis. Moscow, however, denies the allegations. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned on Thursday that a possible breakout of war in the Donbas region could result in the destruction of Ukraine. The Kremlin has said the recent military hardware and troops movements near the border with Ukraine have been aimed at ensuring Russia's security and are not meant to pose a threat to anyone. Moscow has also warned against any deployment of NATO troops to Ukraine, saying such a move would prompt Russia to take extra steps to protect its security. The comments came after Ukraine said it would hold joint military drills with NATO in a few months. Over 1,000 military personnel from more than 5 NATO member states are set to participate in the drills. The war of words between Russia and the West has escalated just over 2 months after Joe Biden took office as the U.S. president. Last month, Biden supported a statement during an interview that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, was, quote, a killer.
So I admire the patience that Vladimir Putin has and how restrained he has been whenever we've had U.S. interference in Ukrainian affairs.
What's evident is that a potential conflict between NATO and Russia would spell disaster for the whole region.
NATO has been in decline for a number of years. And in fact, you look at the U.S. Military's record in fighting wars. They did not win in Vietnam. They've been tied down for 20 years in Afghanistan. You cannot claim a victory in Iraq. They have had... The only thing the U.S. is good at is going in and creating a conflict and then sustaining the conflict indefinitely. The U.S. military has forgotten how to fight a war and win. So the Russians have not forgotten this lesson. I really think that this is going to go very poorly for the U.S., and it's going to go very poorly for the people of Ukraine if this aggression from the U.S. continues in order to displace Russia from their territorial homeland.
Considering the recent developments and a flurry of sanctions the West has been imposing on Moscow, another Cold War might be on the horizon, a crisis that could prove even more costly than the first for both sides.
Mali has been plagued by instability and conflict. It was in 2012 when Tuareg separatists allied with al-Qaeda and Daesh-linked groups launched a rebellion and took control of the north. But soon after, the terrorist groups pushed over the Tuareg rebels and seized key northern cities. However, in the early 2013, Malian forces, together with French troops and soldiers from other African countries, drove them out and gained back control. Since then, Daesh terrorist groups regularly carry out raids against the army and civilians in Mali's central and northern regions. In recent years, fighting has spread across the arid Sahel region into Burkina Faso and Niger, with a deteriorating security situation in the region unleashing a major humanitarian crisis. Violence and insecurity have already pushed some 7.4 million people across three countries into acute hunger. Meanwhile, the number of internally displaced people has reached 1.6 million in 2020. That figure included more than 288,000 people in Mali, some 265,000 in Niger, and 1 million in Burkina Faso, which is now home to the world's fastest-growing displacement crisis. At least 1,000 people overall have died in attacks this year, including soldiers and terrorists. The first 3 months of 2021 have seen more non-combatant deaths blamed on terrorist groups than the same period last year. The UN peacekeeping force, also known as MINUSMA, was established in Mali in 2013 and has over 13,000 peacekeepers from several countries. Over 230 peacekeepers have died in the country, and that has made Mali the UN's most dangerous peacekeeping operation.
Well, Mali is one of the key hubs for the jihadi African Muslim movement. It's all of North Africa right now. You've got Chad, Libya, Sudan, they're, you know, Central African Republic, even obviously North Nigeria, and then you're even Northern Cameroon.
France, a former colonizer of Africa, intervened in Mali in 2013 to fight back increasing militant activity. Mali has received support in its fight against the armed groups from France's Barkhane force, which numbers 5,100 troops spread across the arid Sahel region. In addition to Mali, French force has been fighting armed groups alongside soldiers from the G5 Sahel countries, namely Mauritania, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Niger. However, the French anti-terror mission Barkhane is losing support in Mali. Hundreds of people took to the streets in the capital Bamako to protest against the presence of French troops in the Sahel region. They burned the French flag and carried banners, reading slogans such as Down with France. A recent UN probe found France guilty of killing civilians in central Mali. On January 3, French fighter jets targeted a wedding with nearly 100 guests near Bounty Village in central Mali. A UN report said that 19 civilians, as well as four militants, were killed. The French Defense Ministry, however, disputed the finding, saying the strike targeted an armed terrorist group. However, the UN rejected Paris's claims.
The French are heavily involved, trying to control their resources. Mali's a very rich country in gold, and it's a very valuable asset. Other than that, surprisingly, it's not that rich, but it has a significant amount of gold reserves. It's considered probably one of the richest reserves in the world.
Paris has intervened in Mali in an effort to stop terrorists advancing in the region. However, there are more important things than the lives of over 5,100 French troops. The African country's gold and uranium mines are an incentive for France's current military intervention in that region.
Shortly after taking office as South Vietnam's president in 1955, pro-American Ngo Dinh Diem began a crackdown on suspected members of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition of the North. The Cold War was in full swing, and the United States, which was concerned about a rise in communism, gradually ramped up its military presence in Vietnam. Washington finally found the excuse to justify a war in the region following an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1963 when two U.S. destroyers were targeted by a torpedo attack by the North Vietnamese forces. The U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. The conflict that ensued has been regarded as one of the bloodiest wars the U.S. has ever been involved in. American troops resorted to using warfares, including napalm and chemical toxins, to confront their enemy. Perhaps the most notorious was a chemical substance called Agent Orange that was used during Operation Ranch Hand to defoliate jungles to uncover Vietnamese troops and destroy crops between 1961 and 1971. The substance contained dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals known to man and has been linked to severe birth defects, cancers, and mental and physical disabilities.
You have to understand that America has a different standard for the rest of the world than it does at home. At home, America adheres to fairly high level standards when it comes to herbicides, for example, of which Agent Orange is one. But when it comes to the poor nations of the world, such as Laos or Cambodia, a completely different standard applies.
The U.S. failure in the war and its atrocities in terms of the number of civilian deaths and the use of chemical weapons has tarnished America's image at home and abroad to date. The U.S. rained down some 600,000 gallons of herbicides on the neutral nation of Laos and roughly 19 million gallons of such chemicals in Vietnam. The chemicals were so potent that even American troops got a taste of their detrimental effects. After 14 years of legal dispute, the U.S. Congress passed the Orange Agent Act in 1991 to compensate American veterans of the Vietnam War who were exposed to the toxin. But it wasn't until the year 2000 that Washington started to admit responsibility for what the people of Vietnam and Laos have been going through. Washington kicked off a 10-year project to decontaminate swathes of Vietnamese land from the herbicide in 2019, but stopped short of awarding compensation to the families of the victims. There's also no mention of U.S. chemical attacks on neutral Laos during the war. Even after the American military acknowledged the attacks, a former American commander denied all knowledge about the use of dioxin there.
Laos was a country that was caught in the middle of the Indo-Chinese War. The U.S. Was absolutely indiscriminate in its use of Agent Orange and other weapons of war against the population. It never apologized. It never had any second thoughts. As far as the U.S. was concerned, it was just a collateral damage. So the U.S. has never made good on that. It's never made good on the enormous damage that was done to Cambodia. Or certainly the incredible bloodshed that was imposed on Vietnam.
the Vietnam War ended long ago, but not for thousands of people living in Vietnam and Laos who are still being haunted by its effects.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight.
A new study finds destruction of pristine rainforests increased by 12% in 2020, despite global economic slowdown. Across the tropics, the study registered the destruction in 2020 of 4.2 million hectares, that is about 10.4 million acres of primary forest, 12% higher than the year before. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading A Crisis for Climate Stability. Data shows rainforest destruction accelerated in 2020. Stay tuned for more. Intentional deforestation as well as drought-induced wildfires made more frequent and severe by the climate crisis drove a significant acceleration of global rainforest loss in 2020, with new figures released recently showing that 12.2 million hectares of tree cover were destroyed in the tropics last year. According to data from the University of Maryland and Global Forest Watch, 4.2 million hectares, an area the size of the Netherlands, of destruction occurred among humid tropical primary forests. Scientists say this level of loss is a major blow to the planet's biodiversity and a setback for the fight against the global climate crisis, given the crucial role rainforests play in absorbing atmospheric CO2. The resulting carbon emissions from this primary forest loss are equivalent to the annual emissions of 570 million cars, more than double the number of cars on the road in the United States, noted Michaela Weiss and Liz Goldman of Global Forest Watch, an initiative of the World Resources Institute, WRI. As in the past years, commodity-driven deforestation was the leading cause of tree cover loss, both in primary and secondary forests in Latin America and Southeast Asia, while shifting agriculture dominates in tropical Africa, the pair observed. In addition, fires and other climate-related impacts continue to play a big role, both in the tropics and beyond. Last year was third worst year for forest destruction since 2002, with a loss of primary forest, defined as areas undisturbed by human activity, up 12% compared to 2019. Brazil, where Amazon deforestation has surged under the leadership of President Jair Bolsonaro, led the world in primary forest loss in 2020, according to the new figures. Two bright spots in an otherwise dire report were Indonesia and Malaysia, their primary forest loss declined for the fourth consecutive year. While there is reason to accelerate this decline in primary forest loss, Indonesia and Malaysia must do more to strengthen existing policies to ensure this trend continues, including extending the oil palm plantation license moratorium, which is set to expire in 2021, wrote Weiss and Goldman. Regional climate and market conditions also may have reduced pressure on forests, conditions that could shift and, without the right measures in place, undo progress. Francis Seymour, distinguished senior fellow at WRI, warned recently that continued forest destruction represents a crisis for climate stability and biodiversity conservation, as well as a humanitarian disaster and lost economic opportunity. What we can see from satellites is that when indigenous peoples are present in forests and their rights are strengthened, forest cover is maintained, Seymour wrote. Yet the number of forest defenders being murdered is rising along with the rate of forest loss. With global climate summits on climate change and biodiversity on the calendar, 2021 is a year for solidarity among governments committed to averting the worst impacts of forest loss. It's also time, Seymour added, for solidarity with communities risking their lives to save the world's remaining forests. Plants, especially in the tropics, and soil comprise an enormous carbon sink, sucking up roughly a third of all the carbon pollution humans produce annually. Yet tropical forests continue to disappear rapidly, threatening irreparable losses to Earth's crucial biodiversity. Researchers said the destruction of tropical primary forests in 2020 released 2.64 billion tons of CO2 in 2020, equal to the annual emissions of India, or 570 million cars, more than double the number on the road in the United States. the longer we wait to stop deforestation and get other sectors on to net zero trajectories, the more likely it is that our natural carbon sinks will go up in smoke, Seymour said.
Around the world with reporters.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a have marched on the United Nations office in the city to slam the international community's silence in the face of Saudi's illegal acts. The protesters called for international action amid the continued detention of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today we have completed 2 years of protests in front of the United Nations office. We organized 730 protests to denounce the continued piracy against fuel ships. We have a 1,400-meter-long letter of condemnation signed by the Yemenis. The United Nations and the U.S. are directly observing the detention of oil vessels, and they bear responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
The protesters slammed the U.S. as a key partner in exacerbating the suffering of millions of Yemenis. They said Saudi Arabia's U.S.-backed siege on Yemen has caused a severe shortage of basics, including fuel, food and water, leading to numerous deaths, including among children.
Public sector employees are protesting today in front of the United Nations office because the UN bears the moral and humanitarian responsibility regarding the continued detention of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition as it happens under the direct supervision of the UN.
Since the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade in Yemen, depriving millions of civilians of their necessities and even hampering the humanitarian aid in the war-torn country. This has pushed the country to the brink of famine and has wrecked the healthcare system.
For 2 years now, Yemenis have been protesting outside the United Nations office in Sana'a with no tangible results. However, they say their army is now capable of forcing Saudi Arabia into listening to their voices and lift the blockade it imposed on their country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining participants of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. The sides have set up two expert-level working groups that are going to come up with two lists, one of sanctions to be lifted by the United States and the other of nuclear measures to be undertaken by Iran in order for the country to return to full compliance with the nuclear agreement. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says Tehran is not interested in any step-by-step return to the deal and is demanding the full removal of sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA.
I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance.
Iran says it has not and will not engage in any direct or indirect talks with the U.S., and it would be up to the other JCPOA signatories, namely Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, to talk to the Americans. The Joint Commission will meet again in Vienna on Friday to review the work of the expert groups and discuss sequence and timing. But if there's a lack of progress, Tehran says, it will end the talks. We are not in a hurry, says Iran's lead delegate. Homolezki, Vienna.
This racist, Islamophobic, misogynistic.
The daughter of a Muslim who was murdered by a white supremacist as he walked home from his local mosque has launched a campaign demanding the UK government finally adopt an Islamophobia definition. Maz Salim, whose father, Mohammed Salim, was killed by a neo-Nazi terrorist 8 years ago, has launched the campaign to highlight Islamophobic hate crimes and force the definition back on the government's agenda.
Pablo Lapchin was charged under terrorism laws. It's been 8 years now. I've been tirelessly campaigning against racism and Islamophobia. And still today, my father's name is not being mentioned in the mainstream media as an act of terrorism. And I think that's really important, because whenever a Muslim is a victim, the media is very biased in the way it reports it. It's always such as lone wolf or mosque bomber. Or murderer. No, he was actually, quite frankly, a terrorist. So I want that to be highlighted. That's extremely important.
The campaign includes an online hashtag, I am Mohammed Salim, which others can use to post testimonies exposing how dangerous Islamophobia is becoming.
I've already been inundated with a lot of videos, a lot of footage, which I'm going to release every single day. And if you already look on our Twitter and our Instagram, you can see already people speaking about their experience of racism, Islamophobia and xenophobia. So if you continue to send us these videos, then we can put pressure on the government as to what is exactly happening on our streets today.
Sadly, Mohammed Salim is not the only victim. In 2015, 81-year-old Muhsin Ahmed was killed by two men in a racially motivated attack in Rotherham. And in 2017, Makram Ali was killed during the Finsbury Park terror attack during the holy month of Ramadan. In 2018, an all-party parliamentary group issued a report on anti-Muslim prejudice, which urged the government to define Islamophobia. So far, the government has refused to do so. Islamophobic attacks and racist verbal abuse are becoming near normalised here in Britain, with many Muslims complaining that it's become basically a daily occurrence. But if the government continues to refuse to acknowledge that Islamophobia is a very real and vicious form of hate crime, then preventing future attacks and also providing justice to victims will continue to get all the more harder. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian children continue to suffer due to Israel's inhumane practices as they mark Palestinian Child Day. Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian children over the past decade under the watchful eye of the international community. Last year alone, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinian children. During a press conference marking the annual event, Palestinians demanded that Israeli forces be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian children.
Israeli soldiers are acting with impunity because they feel that they will not be prosecuted for their crimes. Such policies have encouraged Israeli soldiers to violate our rights. The international community must take concrete steps to prosecute those Israeli soldiers who kill and maim us on a daily basis.
Scores of Palestinian children lost their lives during the Great March of Return peaceful rallies due to Israel's use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinian children were systematic.
As we mark Palestinian Child Day, Israel continues to commit grave violations against Palestinian children, including wounding them and killing them. Israel also violates the social, economic, and cultural rights. The Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life for Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged 3 wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children.
The Zionist enemy violates the rights of Palestinian children to live. They have bombed the homes where Palestinian children live and have deprived them from receiving proper education and health care. Palestinian children are even deprived from the right of movement.
Palestinian Child Day highlights the ongoing plight of those born under Israeli occupation and blockade. Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Going without food may seem extreme to some, but for many Yemenis, it's a part of daily life. After Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in 2015, it quickly moved to encircle the nation, and huge swaths of the country have been facing chronic malnutrition ever since. Now, supporters abroad are refusing food as well in an effort to draw attention to Yemeni's desperate plight.
We're here outside the White House, where activists with the Yemeni Liberation Movement have gathered to call for an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led siege on Yemen. Many of them have decided to put their bodies on the line and are now on day six of an ongoing hunger strike in solidarity with the Yemeni people starving under the blockade.
We're here at Washington, D.C. We came all the way from Michigan, and we're in Washington, D.C. to demand an end for the U.S. For the U.S.'s support on the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen, which is causing the biggest humanitarian crisis in the last 100 years. Over 22 million people are experiencing starvation, and every 75 seconds a child dies from starvation.
For the millions deprived of basic supplies like medicine and fuel, every day is a struggle for survival. According to UNICEF, over two-thirds of Yemen's population, or more than 20 million people, are in need of humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, activists say the U.S. government has been working continuously to enable the Saudi aggression.
So the United States is not only complicit in this genocide, they are wholeheartedly and completely supporting it at every possible aspect, militarily, with intelligence and logistics. They have provided billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in weapon sales to the Saudi government, as well as helping the Saudi government enforce the fuel blockade, which is currently enforced since December 2020.
It's been nearly a week since they've eaten, and going without food is starting to take a toll. But these activists are determined to carry on, saying the situation in Yemen has gotten so bad that they simply have no other choice.
Because it gets pretty foggy and hazy. And I think we're also realizing this is only a fraction of what Yemeni people are having to deal with. So we want folks at home to really understand that.
And I just want to add, you know, so many folks say, like, why are y'all starving yourselves? You know, like, you should be doing something else. And really, it's a last resort. If you look at hunger strikes from, you know, the Irish hunger strike or prison hunger strikes, these are people whose power was taken away, and this is a last resort.
Wyatt Reed, Washington.
After a lull of around 20 months, street protests against Indian-ruled resurfaced in Indian-controlled Kashmir. That came after three suspected anti-India fighters were killed by government forces in an anti-militancy operation on Friday in the southern district of Pulwama. Officials say two of the three men were involved in killing a policeman guarding a local politician's house. Like in past, hundreds of people marched towards the site of the gun battle in support of the fighters. They chanted slogans against the Indian rule in the region. Government forces used tear gas and fired shotgun pellets at the stone-throwing protesters, injuring four people. India imposed a security crackdown on Kashmir after August 5, 2019, when it unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomy. The crackdown, coupled with the COVID-19 lockdown, kept people from taking to streets. Indian officials call the Kashmir unrest, quote, Pakistan-sponsored terrorism, a charge that Islamabad denies.
Pakistan.
Through social media, Pakistan is instigating, encouraging and radicalizing the youth of Kashmir to join terrorist outfits. The youth are fearless and innocent. They don't know what they are doing. Whoever chooses this path should remember the outcome is either jail or death.
A senior journalist and political analyst from Kashmir says there is pent-up anger among people, and this is going to be critical this summer.
A series of laws that have come, including other things which are happening at such a galloping pace. So now people are really trying to express their anger, you know, through one way or the other. You